did all the hard lifting are Anton in the back here and Damien also hiding in the back row there. And Sumit Das, some of you may know at Kentucky. So my title combines two different ideas, and so it's a bit of a mashup today, but I wanted to start with a few words about both of those ideas because I know that there's a mixed audience. So Gifra, this is for you, a quantum quench. The basic idea is that we're going to take a system and we're going to kick it. Unfortunately, usually when we do that, evolution isn't terribly interesting, or well, many things happen, but the thing that dominates are processes like decoherence or dissipation. However, as we were told, I think in the last talk, the clever experimentalists have developed systems where those effects can be minimized. And so in a situation like this where I'm changing the coupling suddenly in my Hamiltonian, we can ask, is there some kind of universal behavior that characterizes the subsequent evolution of the system? Or more broadly, what we're doing is we're taking a system far from equilibrium, and so we can ask, are there, you know, what are the organizing principles for this kind of far from equilibrium physics? And so I'm a theorist. There has been theoretical progress made in a variety of different ways by studying different models. And I list some of them here. However, it's probably fair to say that progress has been modest, that we're still lacking or we're still seeking broadly applicable rules or principles and efficient techniques to handle this kind of a situation. So that was my 30-second introduction to the quantum quench idea. Then we have holography. Now, in this case, what I'm really talking about is ADS-CFT, and so with Philip's introduction, we all know that this is the classic model of the unparticle. However, my perspective might be a little bit different. I would say that what we have here is a dictionary that the string theorists have been developing, and they're two very different languages that are describing the same physical phenomena. Now, on one side, or one of those languages, is the language of gravity, which happens to be coupled to a negative cosmological constant. And if I study Einstein's equations with a negative cosmological constant, the typical or the simplest solution is called anti-de Sitter space. And that gives us the ADS in our correspondence up there. On the other side of the dictionary, or the other language that we're using, is quantum field theory. It's not an arbitrary quantum field theory, but a special one that is scale independent. In particular, we're thinking of conformal field theories, or CFTs, and that gives us the CFT in our dictionary. Now, I'm not going to be able to give you any in-depth discussion of what's going on. A couple of interesting features are that this is known as the boundary conformal field theory. It lives, say, in D space-time dimensions, but the gravity theory lives in D plus one dimensions. Now, you may ask right away, what does the gravity theory need an extra dimension for? And so that's a rather simple idea. What the gravity theory does is it organizes excitations or degrees of freedom by energy scale, or the degrees of freedom at different energy scales are organized according to their position or radius in this extra dimension. So if I'm probing the physics deep in the bulk of my gravity theory, then I'm probing the infrared excitations or degrees of freedom of my conformal field theory. On the other hand, if I'm probing degrees of freedom near the boundary, what I'm doing is I'm studying the ultraviolet or high energy degrees of freedom of our conformal field theory. So with that introduction, we want to mash those two ideas together. And the question is, well, what does ADS-CFT have to offer this problem of quantum quenches? Well, it's studying a different set of field theories, typically strongly coupled quantum field theories. It's a situation where real-time analysis is readily at hand. If desired, I can study the system at finite temperature, and being the string theorist, one of the knobs I get to play with is the space-time dimension. This is just, given a gravity theory, it's relatively easy to move between different space-time dimensions. But more broadly, what we might see today is that holography forces us to reorganize the problem and rethink how it behaves, and that by itself may lead to new insights. Now, this isn't an idea that's original to me or any of my collaborators. In fact, a lot of people have been thinking about quote-unquote quantum quenches in the context of holography or ADS-CFT. And so here's a partial list of authors of various papers in the past few years. One of the things you may note if you go try and look up these papers is that nowhere do they say the words quantum quench. Rather, most of this work was aimed at the idea of studying thermalization, or how the strongly coupled field theory gets to a thermal state. And in particular, the goal there is to study the behavior of something known as the quark gluon plasma. However, another interpretation of what was being done is, of course, a quantum quench, or a sudden disturbance of our quantum field theory. An aside for the audience today is that through this dictionary, we're taking the far from equilibrium physics of the boundary conformal field theory, and we're mapping it in some natural way to a situation in a gravitational theory where we're going to study some very interesting evolution. And that's a situation where analytics is often at a loss, but it's opened up a new dialogue with our friends who actually study numerical relativity. And so one of my collaborators, Luis Lehner, is actually an expert who spends most of his time thinking about mergers of black holes out in the far reaches of the cosmos. Okay, let's go proceed a little bit further and ask, I want to do a quantum quench in this sort of holographic framework. Where are the control parameters, or where are the dials and knobs? And so this is a conventional entry in the ADS-CFT dictionary. Let's think about a scalar operator that I'm going to perturb my system by, or this is the thing for which I'm turning on that coupling. On the gravitational side of the dictionary, there's going to be some scalar field propagating around in the ADS geometry, space-time. Now, the equation of motion for that is going to be some conventional equation of motion. The dot, dot, dot means there might have been some interesting potential, and so there might be phi squared, phi cubed, lots of other kinds of interactions, but none of those are going to be important. If I look near the boundary, there are basically two independent solutions to my second order equation, or the linearized version of it, and they're both decaying with some powers of the radius. So R is going to infinity here. Now, the interesting thing that the ADS-CFT dictionary does is it takes these integration constants for these two independent solutions, and it turns them into the parameters that we're interested in. So the first one here is going to be dual to, or mapped to, the coupling constant that sits in front of this operator in the Hamiltonian or in the action. And the second integration constant here gets mapped to the expectation value of that operator in whatever state we're studying. These exponents depend on the mass of the scalar field here. L is the curvature of my ADS space. As I said, I'm going to be fooling around with the space-time dimension. But it's cleverly written here as delta to suggest that, in fact, these exponents are related to the conformal dimension of that operator there. And so that's a part of this dictionary, or this holographic framework, that we're going to use then in producing a quench. So how does that work? Well, here's a cartoon. Here's my asymptotic infinity. That's R equals infinity. Time runs up the picture. And on this side in my cartoon, this is the space-time where things are happening. So what I said is we wanted to change suddenly the coupling constant. So we may want to start at zero and then suddenly at some time bring it up to some finite value like that. What I said is that what that's doing is it's changing the boundary condition of some scalar field in the gravitational theory. And so we're kicking that scalar field. And so when I choose those boundary conditions at this point, I'm going to launch some scalar waves into my ADS space-time. Now, in solving the equations, though, this was one boundary condition. The other boundary condition is going to say I want a reasonable solution or a smooth solution in the bulk. And that's going to determine that other integration constant, which maps onto the expectation value of the dual operator then. And so by closely looking at the full solution, we can pick out that second tail, and we can read off then what the behavior of that expectation value is. Now, if we take a moment and look at this side, what I have is some gravitational problem where I have a shell of matter falling inward, and so that's a gravitational collapse. And so what we expect happens is that these guys fall in towards the center of the space and form a black hole. Now, that's an interesting result because that's another entry in the dictionary that we know about. A black hole actually corresponds to a thermal state in the boundary theory. And so what this intuition suggests is we're going to excite the system, but it's going to eventually settle down into some thermal state. Yes, there's lots of interesting physics that one could do, and I'm sure Alex would love to speak to you about that for hours and hours, but not today. We're going to be in a situation where I'm really going to kick the system hard, and we're going to throw a lot of energy in, and the black hole is always going to end up being what we end up with. In fact, what I was going to tell you next is a few more details about what we actually did. And in fact, rather than starting with the vacuum down here, we already started with a black hole. So we're just starting with a thermal state. We're kicking the system, and that's going to throw more energy in, and we're going to end up with a new thermal state at a higher temperature. More details about what we did. Right, we fix this. This is one boundary condition that we fix, and we read this one off. You mean I chose this value, or are you saying something about this boundary up here? I'm really only playing with this boundary condition at r equals infinity. It's not quite that, but it's some, yeah, something in the scalar field.
I'm just trying to ask, say, what's the time scale in between the meter,
I get to choose that. And we'll see later on. I'm going to be playing with that. You mean how much time takes to get from here to here? Yeah, no, I get to choose that. Sure.
But before you ran the black hole all the way back to the beginning, you were talking about zero temperature.
I could have done lots of things, but when the picture looked like that, implicitly I was thinking this is the CFT vacuum. It's just empty ADS space.
Is there anything like how can you end up with a thermal state?
Unitary
evolution at zero temperature.
That's an excellent question, and I'm not going to address it today. I mean, implicitly, in a way that the string theorists I don't think we really understand. There's some coarse graining that we're doing in describing everything just in terms of the gravitational degrees of freedom. If I look at my favorite examples, there's actually supposed to be a full string theory's worth of degrees of freedom over here, and we're reducing it down to just some simple gravitational theory because that's what we can do.
This is an adiabatic quench, or it could be an
It could be adiabatic. I'm actually going to focus on the what I'll call a fast quench. That's going to be the center of the discussion.
The term is how fast is fast?
There is, yeah. How about we go ahead two slides? So I'm going to
just a few more details. One was I was cheating here, or for technical reasons, we just started with a black hole. I'm going to set the space-time dimension to be 4. I'm going to choose the conformal dimension here, which means I'm choosing the mass of the scalar field in the bulk, such that delta runs from 4 down to 2. That means that it's a relevant operator. In principle, it could run lower than 2, and I'll comment on that later. But this is, from the gravity perspective, that's the natural thing to do. And this is the profile that we use. So it's 1 plus a tanh. So it starts at 0 and then zips up. And I've just set a scale in there, delta t. And I've also set a scale or a parameter here to tell me how big the step is. But one of the games that we played, or basically the game we play, is varying that and seeing how the behavior of the system changes. A few more details. What I said originally is we're going to study this gravitational theory, but in fact, all we did in our numerical simulations was study the linearized scalar wave equation on a fixed black hole background. So we're doing a perturbative calculation, but even in that context, we'll play this game and we can read off or work hard to determine the expectation value by looking at sort of the behavior of the scalar field out there. Another thing that we wanted to determine, to follow, or to think about the behavior of the system is the energy. What we did is the fancy words are it's a diffeomorphism Ward identity. It's basically energy conservation. If everything was constant, this would just say that the stress energy tensor is 0, or the divergence of the stress energy tensor is 0, or here that the energy density is constant. When I'm changing the coupling, I'm doing work on the system, and so there's this source term on that side of the equation. And in our case, when we look at the 0-0 component, this is what we get for the energy conservation. So I'm specifying that lambda. That's what this profile gives. I'm working hard to extract that from our scalar field. But given those two, I can just integrate this and determine the energy density at any time. Yep.
So what do you mean by a fixed black hole geometry? Because you're dumping this energy and it's growing.
Right. So I'm working perturbatively. And so if I went to the next order in my perturbation expansion, what I'd have to do is look at the back reaction of the geometry. And that would also, what I would see is that the mass of the black hole changes, or the position of the horizon is changing. So this is a clever little trick that means I don't have to work that hard. But at the heart of it, it's because I'm doing a perturbative calculation here. And we'll do better later, I promise, but this is where we started. So that's basically the story. So we did some numerical simulations. We picked different values of lambda. We stared at it for a while and wrote two papers. And so 138 pages later, what did we learn? Well, we learned actually a lot of things, but I'm going to only ask you to remember two. So one is that here I have a quantum field theory with time-dependent couplings, and you can renormalize that in a straightforward way. Holography gives us the tools and an approach that I don't have to worry, or it tells me how to remove the divergences in a systematic way. And I should say, this isn't really a new technology. It's something that's been developed over the years by many, many people, and we're just applying it to a particular situation. One of the new things is that our coupling constants are changing, and so some of the divergences actually depend on derivatives of the coupling. So this might be, say, the zero-point energy, so it's proportional to my UV cutoff, if there was a mass, I'd get a subleading divergence that just had the mass squared. But I can also, in this particular case, find counterterms or divergences that are proportional to derivatives of the mass. And then there's a comment down here that, in fact, sometimes you find interesting log divergences. And so that's a reminder to me to say that both for lesson one and lesson two, there are interesting logs. And I'm not going to tell you about any of those today. But feel free to ask me after the talk. So what's lesson number two? Lesson number two is that if we think about fast quenches, so we're taking this limit delta t goes to zero, our simulations, we manage to tease out what looks like some kind of universal behavior. So if I look at the expectation value or the peak of my expectation value, what I find is that it's scaling as an inverse power of delta t, where that exponent is 2 times the conformal dimension of my operator minus 4. Similarly, we could integrate that up to get the energy. And so the amount of energy that went into the system is given by an expression like that with the same scaling. Now, that's interesting because it seems to be saying that, for example, there's an infinite amount of energy going into the system if I actually take delta t to zero. Now, that seems also problematic. And so one might ask, is that a real physical effect, or is it just a pathology or an artifact of this perturbative expansion that I'm doing? Remember, well, I said that I'm doing something perturbative. You might imagine that there are nonlinear terms in delta lambda that become important when, say, the expectation value of O is large, and that they combine together to give us a regular or a finite answer in that particular limit. One of the reasons that I stand here and wring my hands about that is because an instantaneous quench, or the case delta t equals zero, is the basic starting point for a lot of discussions of quantum quenches, or theoretical discussions of quantum quenches in the literature. And so there's a puzzle here that we wanted to understand. And so we went back and thought about this a little bit harder. And so I'm going to go back to my cartoon of the quantum quench. I'm going to change the setup slightly, though. What I'm going to do is I'm going to do a quench now where all of the action happens just in this window, 0 to delta t. So down here, lambda, say, is 0. I can then turn it on in some way, or it can vary. And then at delta t, it stops varying, and it's constant for the rest of the story. And then I'm also going to ask a very specific question. I'm going to ask how much energy gets pumped into the system when I do that. And the reason I'm asking that is that was one of the parameters that seemed to have this pathological behavior. The reason I've set it up like this is, remember, we had our diffeomorphism Ward identity that was telling us that the energy is only changing when the coupling is changing. And so that means then that it's only going to be changing between here and here. And I don't really have to carry on and think about what's happening up here to answer that particular question. And in fact, then, if I turn everything on here, things propagate in along the light cone, or there's some null ray. They travel in at the speed of light. And in these new coordinates that I've chosen, where this is the boundary or infinity is now called rho equals 0, that light cone is just t equals rho. And so, in fact, I don't go that far into the bulk either in those coordinates. There's some minimum value of the radius that's approximately delta t. And so rather than running a full simulation of the whole system, I only really have to consider this little triangle, or this little piece of the space-time that's bounded by the upper time here, the light cone here, and infinity, or the boundary, over there. The game was, though, that I wanted to squeeze delta t and make it shorter. That makes it even simpler. Now I have to look at a smaller triangle, and I can keep going, and the triangle gets smaller and smaller. And so at the end of the day, to answer this question, it seems in this limit that delta t is going to 0, I only really have to think about the behavior of the system in a very small region near the asymptotic boundary or near infinity. So the first is just saying I've set aside the question of the full evolution, but by asking this question or setting up this problem, I'm focusing in on the scaling behavior, or it lets me focus in there. As I said, I don't have to run the full simulation, but in fact, what happens is, or what we discovered is, you can analyze this in a purely analytic way. I don't actually need to run any simulations at all. And again, the key is that I'm only looking at this small asymptotic region in my picture. And part of the our experience with ADS-CFT tells us that all the fields are decaying out there, or I've set up the problem, so they're all decaying out there. And they do so in a very precise manner. And so it turns out that none of the non-linearities of this complicated gravity system really matter. And at the end of the day, the problem that I have to solve is just solve for the linearized wave equation of the scalar in the asymptotic ADS. However, what we're showing, or what we showed in our analysis here, is that the delta E I'm calculating is the delta E for the full nonlinear problem. It's just that the nonlinearities only become important much later on in the evolution. So if this was a string theory audience, I'd spend several slides explaining why that happens that way. But instead today, I'll just show you some pictures to emphasize that we can really calculate. So here's some profile that I chose. Here it's not going from zero to some finite value, but rather it goes up and it goes down. So the peak here is the delta lambda, and it goes from zero back to zero in an interval delta t. It turns out that the solution for the expectation value takes this simple form here. So there's some funny powers of t that appear, some gamma functions, and whatnot. If we draw the pictures for various values of delta, again with d equals 4, we get pictures that look like that. One of the things you might notice about that formula, though, is there's this factor sitting out in front of delta lambda over delta t to that power. And so this is precisely the scaling that we found before. Again, why did we find that? Well, we lucked out and we were studying the right problem to answer this particular question. Again, using the holographic dictionary or this word identity, we can evaluate what delta E is by integrating up over that small interval, and we get these results here. Of course, these are precisely the scalings that I showed you before that we teased out of the numerical work. So before we were asking, you know, is this a physical problem or is it an issue with the perturbative expansion? Well, our analytic approach says that the latter is not the case. Here I decided that it's not a problem, but rather I should adjust my attitude. It's an effect. But it's still, in the limit that delta t is going to zero, we seem to find some divergences. And that really is bothersome to some of us. And so, some comments are that, well, we could consider various other scaling limits where I adjust the amplitude here at the same time that I'm adjusting delta t, and I can keep things finite. But this wouldn't be the standard protocol. It wouldn't be what I saw in Calabresi and Cardi. Some other comments are that, well, this exponent, there is going to be a range of deltas, in fact, where this exponent doesn't indicate a divergence, but where rather I'd get a positive power of delta t, and so those seem to be okay. Another note is, well, why am I getting a divergence, or where is that coming from? And it's really because I have a UV fixed point, or I have this CFT, and so there are degrees of freedom all the way down to zero size. And so as delta t gets smaller and smaller, there's always some more degrees of freedom for this particular model to be excited. If I had a lattice or a finite cutoff, of course, eventually I would run into the cutoff, and this description would have to break down. Still, you might ask, well, here I'm doing holography, some kind of strange quantum field theory that we've never heard of. On the other hand, you know, our friends Calabresi and Cardi did something simple. They looked at free fields that we can understand. So maybe this is just some pathology of these crazy models, and it's not reflected in the original analysis. So this is where Sumit Das came along and convinced me that, well, the way to deal with that is just, let's just study the same problem in the model that these folks who started the game some of these original papers were studying. And so they were looking at a free scalar field. What's the thing that they were changing? What's the coupling? Well, it was the mass squared. So what's the operator, this O delta? Well, it's just phi squared. And what is the conformal dimension? Well, it's just d minus 2. So what we want to study is their problem. But rather than starting with an instantaneous quench, we're going to stick in a finite delta t, and we're going to examine the limit that delta t goes to 0. And so here's my Klein-Gordon equation for the free scalar. But the mass here, I've put in this Tanch profile again. So it starts as a massless scalar field at minus infinity, and then over this window, delta t, it goes up to some finite m squared. The reason you can make progress, or the reason I can make progress, is that, in fact, this is a worked example in a book sitting on my shelf called Burrell and Davies, who was studying quantum fields in curved space-time. And so, in fact, there are analytic solutions for the modes of this equation. And so there's some grungy example, there's some exponential here, and then a hypergeometric function with blah, blah, blah. So we're well on our way. One of the things we can check, or one of the things that Calabresi-Cardi looked at or spent time looking at, was this two-point function for the individual modes. And in general, we just plug in our hypergeometric functions and whatnot, and you get a big mass. But what you can think about is taking the limit that delta t goes to 0. And I should also say that these two exponent, or these two times, I'm pushing far away up to large values. And what you find is a rather simple expression, which I've written in that way because the people who've read the paper up there will recognize that that's exactly the same expression that they found just studying this sudden quench. And so it seems then that our analysis here is matching, or is able to match precisely in this limit to the kinds of things that they're finding in their papers. But what was the kind of question that I was asking in holography? I was asking, well, what is the expectation value of phi squared? So again, I've got my modes. I plug them into the formulas, and what you get is an expression like this. So there's some measure factor integrating over momenta. There are these ugly hypergeometric functions. Now we have to enlist Mathematica, but it's a simple integral to do. The problem is it's a divergent integral, and so we had to introduce a cutoff up there. Otherwise, it would have been infinity. But here, our experience with holography tells us not to worry. These divergences can all be taken care of with appropriate counterterms. But rather than approaching it that way, a much simpler way is just to identify what the finite part of that integral is going to be. So if the mass was not varying, if I just had a constant mass, that would have all reduced down to a simple expression like that. And you can clearly see what the various divergences are. And you can also identify what the counterterms would have been in the effective action, but it's much easier to work directly with this expectation value. This kind of a divergence is coming from an integral that looks like that. So let's just subtract that bit off, and so that'll eliminate the divergence. Similarly, there are subleading contributions, and so we also just stick those in the integral. And then, so this is an example in d equals 5. What that gives me then here is the finite, or the renormalized, expectation value of phi squared. So let's take a look at what that gives us. Well, it gives us graphs that look like this. Here I'm actually subtracting off the adiabatic delta t goes to infinity. And that's why it starts at 0 and ends at 0 over there. But as I adjust delta t, as it gets smaller and smaller, what you see is that the amplitude is shooting up. And so there's an interesting growth there. Let's stick it on a log-log plot. What we see is there's a nice straight line. You can fit that. You find that the slope is very, very close to a number that we might recognize. Just for fun, let's compare that to the scaling that holography gave us. So there was something like that. Delta is now d minus 2, d minus 4, 1. So that might have been a coincidence. Let's try some other dimensions. Whoa, okay. Well, it seems that this formula is working rather well, even though we're talking about free scalar fields. There's one thing I might mention. Here in d equals 4, we get a 0. That's actually one of those logarithms that I promised not to tell you about. And that's why this line isn't a straight line, but it's still the expected result. And so we're recovering this holographic scaling from the free field theory. I can extend that to fermions, more straight lines. But it really begs the question, why should free fields behave anything like a holographic model? Well, there's an argument that one can make in the context of conformal perturbation theory. So let's imagine this is the action for my original CFT, and then this is the perturbation. Here's my operator, here's my coupling. I'm going to set it up so that there's an overall scale that tells me how big the step is, and then there's some profile that varies around, but it varies with this scale delta t. And so I want to ask a simple question to ask is, what's the expectation value, say, at t equals 0? Well, I want to evaluate that expectation value in a path integral weighted here. But what I can think of that as being is this operator with this particular exponential insertion in the CFT. Then what we do is we expand our exponential, and we get lots of terms coming out. One of the things to note is that for every interaction, there's a delta lambda that sits out in front, and then there's a bunch of integrals like that. One of the neat things about this perspective is I can throw away this term. This is the expectation value of some relevant operator in the CFT vacuum, so that should be 0. And so it says that the series actually starts here. These are CFT correlators. There's only really one scale in the game, that delta t. And so up to numerical factors, I should get powers of delta t coming out. And so it seems that I'll get an expansion that looks like that. This term may be familiar, but there's a lot of other stuff out here. But then one pauses to think that, well, this looks like an expansion in delta lambda, but delta lambda is actually a dimensionful quantity. And what we should do is organize it in terms of an expansion of some effective coupling that's dimensionless. So if we think about what the dimensions of delta lambda were, then by sticking enough powers of delta t in there, I get a dimensionless coupling. And so if I rewrite this, what I get is an expression that looks like that. So there's some overall factor of delta t that's just giving me the dimensions of my operator. And then there's an expansion in this coupling g. But now what you can do is you can think about, what is the protocol or what's the quench that I'm doing? Well, it's one where delta lambda is fixed. Delta t is going to 0. I'm thinking about a relevant operator, so this power is positive. And so what that means is I'm taking a limit where g is going to 0. So that means this is a really good expansion. And in fact, it seems clear that the leading term should be the one that dominates the result. And so in fact, we expect to get that result quite generally. It seems that it's not a pathology, but it's really of the holographic model, but it's really quite a general result that should appear. What about this tension with Cardi and Calabresi? Well, one of the things to note is that, well, I said before, that exponent doesn't always have to be positive. It can be negative in certain situations. In particular, for this problem, when d equals 3, turns out the answer is minus 1, and so you can expect finite answers there. In fact, much of this paper was focused on the cases d equals 2, d equals 3, where things should be finite then. And so, well, I'll just leave it at that. And so I'll just leave my last slide up there because Gifre is looking rather anxious. There's some slogans, some lessons, and then advanced lessons at the bottom. So I'll thank you for your attention.
Well, let's take a couple of questions.
Jiagang.
So here you start with a conformal field theory.
Sure.
And then you add a perturbation which is relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And the only input is the scaling dimension of this operator.
Yep.
So it looks like you don't care what kind of operator it is. So as long as you know the scaling dimension of operator, you get this some kind of universal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And
you understood.
But I thought to the maybe there's even when the two operators with same scaling dimension, maybe there are some other particular properties. So one may deface more quickly than another, you know.
I can certainly make the problem more complicated if that's what you want me to do. But then I'd have to turn to my grad students in the back of the room and ask them to go run some computer code for me. I'm looking at a very simple problem. I picked a particular operator. It had a fixed dimension.
We have a sum of perturbation with scaling dimension. If you know the scaling dimension, then the result you have here just fit. We don't need, so this result will apply to any perturbation with a certain scaling dimension.
I think that's what this argument was. Maybe I'm still not understanding quite the question, but.
I'm worried about when some operator may come to some other mode more strongly when the other operator. So it looks like it's not only scaling dimension, maybe there are some other things.
Oh, yeah, okay. Maybe this might answer. For example, in the holographic setup, I said that in principle, there could be all sorts of nonlinearities. Gravity inherent, even if it was a free scalar field in ADS, gravity is inherently nonlinear, and so the problem is nonlinear. I didn't impress that on you because I didn't think it was that important, but the key thing there was that, you know, we went towards this UV fixed point. We went to a regime where those nonlinearities decayed away, or they simply were not important for the problem. So there's a lot of other interesting physics here, certainly, but it's because I'm taking this limit that I'm really focusing in on the UV. In particular, you know, this other regime, I have to confess, here's the number it fits, but I don't really understand how this is working. This would say that I pump no energy into the system, but I that's not true. So there's finite physics that we haven't studied here that you know, of the kind you're saying, that in particular in this case would be very important.
Yeah.
On the basic question, I wonder whether there is a major difference between a quantum quint and a classical quint.
I'll turn to Anushka. Any comments, Anushka?
Classical quint versus quantum quint. So, one big distinction is usually energy constant, thermal bath versus not, right? So the quantum quint is you're imagining an isolated quantum system and unitary evolution with EDIHT. Classical quenches or Ramseur stuff, usually you imagine there's some source of stochasticity, there's some bath you couple to, and then you drive the system. So it's different. You can, I don't know how to make them.
However, at some level, because I'm
studying these weird holographic theories in the first half of the talk, you're really, I didn't talk about this, but you're going to the large end. You're going to a particular limit of the theory where I've reduced it down to a classical set of equations of motion in the gravity theory, and so a lot of that stochasticity it's suppressed in our calculation. In fact, you're not seeing it at all in our calculation. So, at some point. I don't know. It's interesting. It might be a meeting point of those two different kinds of processes.
And also, I think you would expect classicality or whatever it is to emerge only in the IR in this language, right? So somehow you have to see the fact that you've heated your system to finite temperature and you want to, I think that's right, is that right? That looking in the IR, you'd actually see that you've heated the temperature, heated the system up, there's a black hole. And you don't expect something to be classical like, at zero temperature. So it might be it's also where you, at short time scales, you can always tell that this is coherent quantum dynamics. On long time scales for local observables, you might get some effect of classical dynamics at late times.
How can one tell the difference between classical quantum quantities by telling, by looking at the scaling of any kind of behavior?
Those are interesting questions, but
beyond what I know. If you want to comment again, feel free.
I feel like the experimental thing. I know nothing. You tell me.
So in the gravity calculation, if you had a finite radius, if you could ubiquitous really at finite radius.
Yes.
And then do the instantaneous quench.
Yes.
And does black hole grow into a size order of the radius?
Yeah, no, the I'm pumping a whole whack of energy in there, and so implicitly the black hole is getting very, very large. And so as I said, I've implicitly, renormalized the theory and removed the cutoff. But if I keep it finite, I'm gonna run into that cutoff then eventually, and this story breaks down when that happens. Well, that's a whole other story. The problem is that if we go way back to the beginning, I said that there were these two powers. And the problem is that that's a positive power. It's decaying if it's a relevant operator. If it's an irrelevant operator, it's actually growing. And so that's a very different problem to study, because it really, if I turn that on by a finite amount, in some sense it's going to end up destroying the ADS asymptotic geometry. And so it's not impossible, but it's not a problem that's studied as well. You would have to keep the cutoff finite, and you would, well, there'd be all sorts of interesting physics to study before we got to the problem of quantum quenches, to develop the technology there on the holographic side. William, is William allowed to ask a question?
No, I think we have to move on.
I have the hockey stick. William, ask a question. Come on.
So,
he's a nice guy.
I have an
okay. So he's going to ignore me. You can ask
me.
Move.
I have an announcement. So we'll have a dinner at 6 p.m. And this is the bistro, the second floor. And this is for speakers and those people who have been exclusively invited by the organizers. And after that, so now Eduardo will take over and he'll lead the discussion. And I'll leave the details to Eduardo. But before that, let's thank the speaker.